When I think about Elon Musk becoming the head of a government initiative that single-handedly might be responsible for 14 million deaths, or I think about Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post and flipping its editorial perspective, it feels obvious that extreme inequality is deforming our democracy. But in a world of people telling you that inequality is the problem, Lane Kenworthy, a professor at UC Santa Barbara, has a different perspective. It's one that I'm not totally sure I'm convinced by. In Kenworthy's new book, Is Inequality the Problem?, he argues that when you zoom out to the country level and compare places with rising inequality against outcomes that we care about, like democracy or opportunity or health outcomes like longevity, you can't really see the kind of pattern you would expect if inequality was really the driving force behind these issues. My name is Jerusalem Demsis. I'm the founder and editor of The Argument, a magazine dedicated to revitalizing liberalism for the 21st century. On this podcast, we bring together people from across the political spectrum, from socialists to conservatives, to talk about the most important issues of the day. The argument is against subtweeting. We state our opinions clearly and we engage with our opponents directly. For an ad-free version of this episode, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com. Lane, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
So I want to start, we're talking about your book today, Is Inequality the Problem? And you answer that for us very helpfully immediately with the first title of your first chapter, No. I think you could have just called the book Inequality is Not the Problem, but perhaps that was too controversial. So I want to start with where you're situating yourself in this debate. Who is saying that inequality is the problem? Why is this debate even important?
Yeah, so my conclusion to jump ahead is I do think inequality is a problem, just not the problem. And so what do I mean by that? Well, for a long time, people like me have thought that too much inequality of income or wealth is morally, ethically objectionable. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the core argument against high levels of inequality up until about 20 years ago. Since then, we've gotten a steady stream of research and argument commentary suggesting that economic inequality, income or wealth, mainly income, that's what we have the most data on, so that's what most people focus on, has a variety of harmful effects. It's bad for economic growth. It's bad for household income growth. It causes people to take on too much debt. It's bad for democracy, bad for health, and so on. If that's true, it probably makes the argument in favor of doing something to reduce inequality much more compelling to people who don't find the moral, the ethical argument all that compelling. And so it's a wide variety of people who have jumped to this conclusion, some based on research, some, I think, because the hypotheses behind this conclusion seem quite compelling. They're very believable, very plausible. And there is more and more research that's consistent with the hypothesis. And so I have a long list of quotes right at the beginning of the first chapter of people who are very smart, very thoughtful, who I agree with on many things.
This is the argument, Lane. You're being too nice.
Well, you know, I should also say, I mean, I've long been an ethical egalitarian. And so in the early years of this research, as I read it, I mostly nodded my head in agreement, thinking, yeah, that's very likely true. It's got to be true. It wasn't until I really began to look very closely at the data that I ended up being more skeptical.
So I want to start with just what we actually, why you actually think people care about this issue. Because there are a lot of things to care about in the world, right? Like there's absolute poverty, there's health inequality, there's racial inequality, there's, wars. There are lots of things that people might want to fix, but we've seen inequality take really center stage in a lot of what you're talking about. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of your book, you know, you have a bunch of quotes from folks about this issue. I mean, it's folks people will have heard of, like, you know, Ezra Klein or Bernie Sanders or Sam Moyn. These are like professors and writers, and Paul Krugman, another economist writer. I mean, people who are in many ways like in your camp in many respects of thinking about politics and policy on from a more left perspective. And it's become a big focus for a lot of them to focus on inequality. Bernie Sanders, I think, is in particular this kind of idea around the 1% as being kind of the source of a lot of the ills in our society. So why do you think people care so much about income and wealth inequality?
I suspect that for most of them, it's the same as for me. That is to say, the moral, the ethical objection is pretty strong. And so, you know, I consider myself an egalitarian. What do I mean by that? Well, I think most of what determines where you or I or anybody else ends up in the distribution of income or wealth is out of our control. You know, it has to do with everything from genetics to our parents, to the neighborhood we grow up in, to the country we grow up in, to the things we're interested in, to the moment in history that we, you know, emerge as human beings. All of that is morally arbitrary. And so, you know, while a bit of inequality is okay, a lot is objectionable. And so I think most people who, you know, I quoted the beginning of the book, and there are plenty of others too, were already primed to find, let's say, contemporary American levels of income or wealth inequality problematic, objectionable. We'd like to see it be less. And so that, you know, when there are additional hypotheses that say, yeah, it might have harmful effects. Oh, I guess I should also say, I think many of us have been frustrated or disappointed that the issue doesn't resonate or doesn't seem to resonate with more people. Mm-hmm. There's lots of public opinion polling which suggests that half or more of Americans think that the level of inequality is too high, or the gap between rich and poor is too great. And more than half, you know, depending on the poll, depending on the moment in time, will say that they think it's government's responsibility to do something about this. You can even get, you know, if you ask people if they think income inequality is a major issue or, you know, one of our most important issues, mm-hmm. a fair number will say yes. And yet, if you ask an open-ended question, I mentioned this in the book, what are the country's most important problems? You almost never see anybody mention inequality or the gap yeah. between rich and poor. And there's just not much indication that elections hinge on this issue. You know, even though there have been moments of temporary excitement, you know, Occupy Wall Street after mm-hmm. the great financial crisis, Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016, which was about a lot more than inequality, but inequality was a core component. So anyway, the fact that lots of people don't seem as jazzed or worried or frustrated with this issue as we egalitarians are, I think also makes it more tempting, inclines us more strongly to believe or latch on to these kinds of arguments and conclusions that income inequality is not only morally objectionable, but has lots of other harmful effects. So even if you could care less ethically about the distribution of income, if income inequality, if high levels of income inequality are bad for people's health, you know, that might be a real reason to care about it.
So I want to ask what we actually know about what's happened to inequality since 1970, because I think there's a general intuition around it having increased, but there are a bunch of different you know, measures of it, and we don't have to get too in the weeds, but, you know, what do we know right now about inequality since 1970 in the U.S., internationally? What does the evidence tell us?
So the real cut point is somewhere around 1979, 1980. I mean, there's no hard and fast particular year or moment in time, but roughly speaking, as best we can tell from the data we have, income inequality declined from the 1910s or 1920s until the late 1970s. And since then, it's gone up. This is true in most of the rich, longstanding democratic countries. So the United States, most of Western Europe, Canada, Japan, Australia, those kinds of countries. It's changed to varying degrees. And it also depends a little bit on where in the income distribution or wealth distribution you want to focus. So there are two main, to kind of simplify, there are two main ways to view this or think about this. One is the gap between the top 1%, or, you know, you could say 0.1 or 2%. Mm-hmm. But roughly speaking, people use the 1%. The gap between the income share of the 1% and everybody else. So if income or wealth were perfectly equally distributed, the top 1% would have 1% of the income or wealth. Instead, in the United States, as of the mid to late 1970s, they had maybe around 10%. Again, this depends on the particular measure or data source. And now it's up to somewhere between 15 and 20%. Another way to think about it is just inequality across the whole distribution, you know, all the way from the top through the middle to the mm-hmm. bottom. And there, for those 1% data, by the way, we get that information mainly from income tax records. The other source of income is surveys. So every one of these rich democratic countries has a survey like our Census Bureau does. About once a year, they ask people what their income was the previous year. And from that, you can calculate some measure of inequality, often something called a Gini coefficient, which is a complicated measure, but a larger number means more inequality. And so, that, you know, that tells us about inequality throughout, although it doesn't really, you know, highlight exactly where the inequality is occurring. But anyway, that too has gone up quite a bit in a number of these countries, more in the United States than elsewhere. There are, for both measures, there are a few countries, few of these rich, longstanding democratic countries where there's been actually no increase or very, very little since, you know, roughly 1979, 1980. But in most, it's gone up. And that's a contrast to what was happening for most of that period from, you know, let's say the 1920s until the late 1970s.
So I wanted to ask you about those countries because I wanted to, I thought they could help illuminate something. So you point out in your book that there are a number of, you know, high SES countries that have not actually seen at all or minimal levels of a rise of inequality, places like Switzerland, like Austria. What explains these places maintaining a certain level of inequality?
Yeah, it's a really mixed story because there are so many things that come into play here. And again, it differs depending on whether you're talking about that sort of very top end inequality, you know, how far away is the top 1% from everybody else, or whether you're talking about inequality throughout the whole distribution, which might be mainly a function of the gap between, let's say, the upper middle class and everybody else, or maybe it's the those at the bottom who are falling farther behind everybody else. So, you know, everything from the strength of labor unions, which can have a big effect on wages, to the flexibility of the labor market, which is going to have a big effect on employment. And one of the main contributors to incomes being low at the bottom end is people not, you know, not having an employed person in the household. Of course, various government social programs matter a lot in the way that they get money to people who otherwise wouldn't have an income, whether they're retired, disabled, unemployed, whatever it might be. And then if we're thinking about what's going on at the top end, it's everything from, again, the strength of labor unions who have something to say not only about wages at the bottom and in the middle, but also compensation packages for those at the top, to corporate governance, you know, the rise of the shareholder value approach, which said that the sole mission of the firm is to raise the stock price for shareholders. And that means, you know, if that means cutting wages or freezing wages or moving factories or offices abroad or whatever it might be, that can lead to more inequality, to the rise of finance, to exploding stock markets. So there really are a large number of factors
really,
that can come into play. And I think the story is really quite different depending on the particular country and the particular inequality measure that you're looking at.
But I mean, the thing that you do in your book that I think is really useful is that you kind of look at a cross-country comparison and you say, like, okay, if we would expect, like, let's say what you just brought up, labor unions. If labor unions were really the reason why you saw less inequality in some places than in others, then you could just look at places where you see, like, higher degrees of labor union penetration and you would see those countries as popping out as you know, as having, you know, dealt with their inequality problem through that mechanism, and you'd see that relationship show up in the data. But like, I haven't done this correlation myself, but like, there are lots of places with very high labor penetration, as you mentioned, the Nordic countries, but there's still like significant inequality in those places. And then there are places with very low, obviously very poor countries with very low inequality and very low labor force or labor union participation or penetration. And so like, that feels like, even in a corporate governance question, I mean, how strongly do you feel like those are really explaining what's going on in some of these places?
Yeah, well, as I was saying, it really is a mixed bag. It's hard to, and a little bit unfortunate from a policy perspective or a solutions perspective, to grab onto a single factor. And there have been researchers who've looked at this much more carefully than I have. Mm-hmm. And they, too, suggest that, okay, labor union strength clearly matters, but it's not overwhelmingly the dominant determining factor here. about whether, and if so, to what degree, income, or especially even more so, wealth inequality has gone up in these countries. Mm-hmm. And as you said, interestingly, you know, the Nordic countries are have, I think, some of the best institutional and policy setups of any of these rich, longstanding democratic nations. But mm-hmm. even there, we've seen non-trivial rise in income inequality. And mm-hmm. I should also say comparatively high levels of wealth inequality, mm-hmm. Surprisingly to many people.
So I want to ask you why you focus on the country level in your book. So you look at what explains the variation between countries on income inequality and wealth inequality, rather than, you know, at a subnational level or at like more of an individual level, like how do individuals respond to inequality, which I think is actually how most people tend to think about this problem, or just like they look around maybe their communities in a local way or in their own lives and they can see that inequality might create different choices or different attitudes in their areas. So what does the country level do for us?
So here's the way I think we should think about this. Again, many of the hypotheses that suggest income or wealth inequality will have bad effects on, let's say, living standards or opportunity or health or happiness, they're very plausible. Mm-hmm. And we have a growing number of individual level studies. Sometimes that's experiments, you know, put people in a lab and put one people in a context of high inequality and another in a context of low inequality. And you'll see those in the high inequality context be more likely to behave selfishly. Mm. We also have survey data that are consistent with some of the hypotheses, again, at the individual level, with some of the hypotheses that says inequality will have harmful outcomes. But with these kinds of evidence, we don't know for certain whether it's going to scale up to the national level. And the real question that I'm trying to answer in this book is, what should we advise policymakers to do or not do about inequality? Mm-hmm. And so the analytical question, what are the consequences, what are the effects of inequality, is important. But it, in my approach here, I'm trying to get that answer because I want to derive policy conclusions. Mm-hmm. And so if we're not certain that individual level effects will scale up, then it's hard to know, it's hard to infer what to tell policymakers based on the results of those individual level analyses. And here I think, I mentioned this, I think in the first chapter of the book. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's influenced me in thinking about this approach is to take a policy recommendation that many people on the left will disagree with. Okay. That's the standard conservative policy recommendation to reduce taxes. Mm-hmm. The hypothesis being that lower taxes are especially good for economic growth, but also beneficial for some other outcomes as well. Well, the hypothesis behind that, or hypotheses, I should say, there are multiple ones, are very plausible. At core, the notion is that people respond to financial incentives by working harder, investing more, getting more education, be more likely to start up a business, whatever. Mm-hmm. We also have lots of individual level, mainly experimental, but also other evidence that's consistent with the hypothesis. The reason why many people like me are very skeptical about that piece of policy advice is because we don't observe what the hypothesis predicts at the country level. We don't mm-hmm. see countries that reduce taxes getting faster economic growth, countries that increase taxation getting slower economic growth. When we look and compare across countries, we don't see the ones with the lowest levels of taxation having faster growth, and those with the highest levels of taxation having the slowest growth. Mm-hmm. So I want to apply the same criteria, the same sort of expectation to these hypotheses that income inequality has bad effects. Mm-hmm. It's not enough to say the hypothesis is plausible. It's not enough to say we have evidence at the individual level that's consistent with it. We also want to look to the country level. And so that's what I try to do in the book.
Just as you drew out with the example of low tax rates, right? Like, you're not contesting that if people were able, like if in a room you said, okay, Jerusalem, you can either keep $100 or $150 if you're able to successfully complete this test, that I'm more motivated if I can keep $150. Like, you still believe that that's like likely true? Maybe it ends at some number, like maybe $1 million is the same thing to me as like 1.5 million. But, you know, at some numbers, you do see that incentive. So when it comes to the inequality question, though, then how does that work? So like, what world is it in which like it is true that inequality can have all of these micro effects on people, but it doesn't add up to this bit broader story? Like, how would that actually work?
Yeah, so either the effects are not large enough that they're not generating large-scale societal shifts in, let's say, economic growth, mm-hmm. or in the case of the inequality as harmful hypotheses in health or happiness or democracy. Or there are offsetting consequences of either low taxes or inequality that offset the behavioral consequences that we see in lab experiments or in other micro level data, or there are other processes at the societal level that are so influential that they're swamping any effects that we see of, again, mm-hmm. either low taxes or inequality. And it might, you know, as to which one of these is occurring or which one is the strongest, that might differ from outcome to outcome. Again, whether we're looking at changes in living standards or happiness or health. But whatever outcome we're looking at, I think if we want to be confident in saying to policymakers that you should prioritize reducing income inequality mm-hmm. Because it's very likely to have these harmful effects, we should see some support for that at the country level. Or if we don't, we should have a very good story as to why policymakers should go ahead and pursue that anyway, despite yeah. the fact that, you know, we don't see strong country level support.
So I think this is actually where, I mean, I'm glad you brought this up, because this is, I think, where I mean, my prior is like that you're like, you have to be wrong, Lane. Like, that's where I am. I'm like, this is, it feels extremely wrong to me that there's not some large issue with, particularly I think democracy is where I find it to be really implausible. I mean, to me, I was more skeptical of the inequality thesis before I watched Elon Musk single-handedly both like wreck the federal government and also was able to, you know, eliminate USAID, which ends up having the impact of, I mean, potentially like millions of people dying. And it seems like quite clear to me that this one person would have no ability to have that kind of power and impact if he wasn't the richest man in the world and didn't command that kind of like attention, particularly when it comes to Twitter, but also his engagement. Obviously, you have to think about this in a counterfactual way. Like, even before Elon Musk existed, there were like really horrible things that were happening in the world. And the question is whether more or fewer of those things would have happened in a world where Elon Musk was not allowed to accumulate that much wealth. But just to like be clear about where my priors are, like, I've really been influenced by that experience to think that like this is clearly having an issue in our politics here in the US at least. And so one macro point that I want to pull out, which you state a lot in your book, which is that the data underlying a lot of these measures of inequality is quite limited. It's like very, very difficult to actually get at the core questions that people are talking about. And my friend Dylan Matthews at Vox, he had a great piece a few years ago about the debate between Piketty, Sayes, and Zuckman, and Auten and Splinter. It was a very, very like vicious debate about how much inequality there really was. And what was interesting is that like both of them were saying inequality had risen. They were just differing by how much. And when Dylan kind of really looked into it, and we'll link this this piece in the show notes, you know, his conclusion, I'll just read it right now because I thought it was really good, is, quote, "Holding firm convictions about the state of inequality is probably a mistake. Measuring the stuff is hard, much harder than it appears at first glance. Simple approaches, like just looking at reported taxable income, can be misleading, as can focusing on how much Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk made in the stock market. It's easy to make errors or leave aspects of the work incomplete. We have to exist in a state of frustrated uncertainty." And, you know, his conclusion there comes after him looking at all of the different assumptions that are made by these very well-respected researchers and concluding that, like, they had made reasonable assumptions in different directions at different points, and that there's not really a clear right answer there. And that speaks to exactly what you were just saying about the goal of a lot of this type of research that is super applicable to these policy questions is to actually help policymakers make decisions right now. Like, policymakers can't wait until we have a dispositive RCT on everything before they decide what welfare policy looks like or what tax rates look like, because those things have to exist even without that research existing. So I guess to me, like, your book indicates that, like, there's limited evidence that inequality has created a bunch of problems in democracy, in people's reported happiness, in health, etc. But I don't think that actually moves my prior that, like, even if the evidence right now isn't very good, I'm kind of surprised you end up in a place where you think that inequality still isn't something to put a lot of effort into. So help me understand how you get there.
Yeah, so I would put my conclusion differently. The conclusion is not that there's limited evidence that inequality has harmful consequences, again, for living standards, democracy, whatever. It's instead that the best evidence we have right now suggests that income inequality probably doesn't have harmful effects. Not that, you know, it suggests that we do, but there's just very little evidence, but instead that the best evidence we have over a period where, you know, for analytical purposes, it's very useful that we have all these countries moving in the same direction, but to different degrees. I can say more about that if you want. This suggests to me that the proper conclusion right now, the best conclusion we can draw, is considerable skepticism about income inequality and, to some degree, wealth inequality, although we have a lot less data there. And so I do think with wealth inequality, it's much more accurate to say that it's just very difficult to draw any conclusions at this moment. But, you know, at the same time, stepping back, I want to emphasize that we should always keep trying to get better data, get more data, improve our measures, reanalyze. You know, it may be that I have everything exactly right for this set of 20 or so rich democratic nations for this 40-year period between 1979 and 2019. But the whole thing has changed all of a sudden. And so 5-10 years from now, when somebody reanalyzes the data and adds in the new period, maybe the story will be very different. Mm-hmm. But I do want to say that my conclusion here is that we should be skeptical, that we should lean towards skepticism about these hypotheses right now, rather than leaning toward agnosticism. We just don't know.
Well, then let's step back then, because, I mean, you have so many pieces of evidence in this book, and folks who are interested will link this in the show notes as well for them to buy. But what are the best pieces of evidence that inequality is not the problem?
Yeah, so I try to work through in separate chapters what we can tell about the impact of income inequality, because again, we just don't have that much data for wealth inequality, on, first of all, living standards, and there I look at economic growth and household incomes, and then household saving as a measure, the sort of inverse of household debt. A second outcome is democracy. The third is opportunity, and there the focus is on equality of opportunity. The fourth is health, there a focus on life expectancy, and the fifth is happiness or life satisfaction. And we've got pretty good cross-national comparative and over time data for living standards, health, and happiness. We have a lot less data for democracy and opportunity. And so maybe let me say something about democracy, because that I think, you know, as you suggested for yourself, that's the one where I think many people's priors are the strongest. Mm-hmm. It just seems like it's got to be true that income inequality is really bad for democracy. And so let me just try to quickly, and please cut me off if I end up rambling on this. Let me say what I think the relevant evidence is and what I think the right conclusion at this moment in time is. So with democracy, one way to think about democracy is equality of opportunity for political influence, for influencing policy outcomes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's only part of the story, but I think it gets at the core of what most of us think of by democracy. So social scientists have been trying to look at this for a long time, but mostly based on just kind of single case studies. So you go and look at a piece of legislation that passed during the New Deal or the 1960s or that was blocked at some other moment in time, and you sort of try to figure out, okay, who acted? You know, was it labor unions? Was it corporate interests? Was it rich people? Was it policymakers themselves? And you try to sort of sort out the causality. That's very useful, and over time, social scientists accumulated more and more of these, but it ends up not being especially comprehensive. So about 10, 15 years ago, Martin Gillens, a political scientist who then I think was at Princeton, now is at UCLA, with a team of researchers, tried to do something more systematic. He tried to link public opinion survey data, which also usually asks people what their income was, and you know, it's kind of a crude measure of income, but you can more or less sort people into three bins: high incomes, middle incomes, low incomes. And figured out what, from the public opinion surveys, what people's views were on a whole array of policies, and then looked to see what happened with those policies within the next 5 years. And the gist of his conclusion was that people with high incomes in the United States, this was only in the US, get what they want from policymakers much more frequently than people with middle incomes or low incomes.
This was breaking news,
This
wasn't
it was a
it?
huge advance.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of limitations. You know, he's only looking at legislative outcomes, not executive actions or regulatory actions or judicial decisions. He could only look at issues where the public opinion surveys asked the questions. It was a crude measure of income. Couldn't say anything about the top 1% because you can't isolate them in these surveys that Gallup or the General Social Survey or the American National Election Studies are doing. The sample sizes are just too small. But nonetheless,
Not enough
in terms of,
billionaires.
yeah, that's right, or even millionaires. But
Yeah.
it nevertheless was a big advance, much, much better than any evidence we had up to then. So that's consistent with the hypothesis that says inequality is bad for democracy. Given that the rich get what they want from policymakers more often than those in the middle and the bottom, you would predict that as inequality goes up, income inequality goes up, the rich would have even more of an advantage relative to others. Gillens and his team of researchers didn't really do much over time analysis, but they do a little bit. And surprisingly, what they found was that there wasn't any increase in inequality of political influence between, say, the 1980s and the early 2000s. That's all they did, and nobody has tried to extend this since. In a few other rich democratic countries, social scientists have tried to replicate this kind of approach. And surprisingly, they've found pretty similar patterns of the rich getting what they want much more frequently than those in the middle and at the bottom of the income distribution. This is even true in some of the Nordic countries. Norway just happens to be the only real exception to this rule. So that's not really consistent with what we would expect to find. If you look over time in the United States and say, well, the main mechanism, the main way that the rich get what they want out of policymakers is by influencing election outcomes, by providing campaign contributions, you would expect to see a huge and growing advantage for Republicans in campaign donations, especially after Citizens United.
I mean, would
But that's
we?
not at all what we see.
But why Republicans? I mean, this is my thing too. I mean, you say this in the book a few times too. Like, there are a lot of wealthy Democrats, and there are a lot of them, particularly in the states that you note are high income inequality, like New York, California, Washington, etc. And like, you can have, like, I mean, we've seen this. I mean, David Brockman had a great. He's a political scientist at UC Berkeley, and he looked at like preferences of elites. And one thing you can pull out from his research is that they're much more okay with certain types of there are a lot of elites that are very okay with like socially liberal policies, even tax and transfer. They just dislike a lot of types of regulations that affect them. And anyway, my point is more just like I don't think it's like obvious to me that you would see a high share of Republican wins in growing inequality tracking together.
Yeah, so we do, of course, now have more billionaires who are, would call themselves liberal or progressive, certainly have lefty views on social and cultural issues. Many of them still have preferences for lower taxes, less regulation of finance, weaker labor unions, although not all. But you would expect to see some movement. Most of this is fairly recent. And so if we think about the period of rising income inequality, which again starts around 79, 80, something like that. We would expect to have seen some movement in that direction, at least prior to the very recent period of the Bill Gateses and some others who might have less Republican-oriented policy priorities. Mm-hmm. The cross-state pattern that you just mentioned, the fact that we see most of the very highest income inequality states across the country being to the left politically and adopting, it's not just electing Democrats, but also having more lefty policies. I mean, none of them are Sweden or Norway, but they're certainly to the left of many of the other states across the country. That also is not what we would expect to observe. So the conclusion that I draw is that our best guess, again, we need much more data, much more research on this, but to me, what seems most likely the right conclusion at this moment in time is that income inequality is bad for equality of political influence, mm-hmm. but there's probably a tipping point beyond which it just doesn't matter very mm-hmm. much anymore. And it's quite possible, in fact, my best guess is that we probably were close to that tipping point, even at our low point of income inequality in 1979, 1980. And so mm-hmm. most of the rise in inequality since then just hasn't had much impact on furthering the political advantage of the rich. I guess one other thing I'll throw in and mention here is that most of the massive change in taxation, lowering tax rates of those with the highest incomes, that occurs very early in this period, really essentially at our low point of income inequality in the United States. So the 1981 Reagan tax cuts are by far the biggest tax cut we've had in terms of lowering tax rates on the rich. And in 1981, income inequality, and to a lesser degree, wealth inequality, we know now, was pretty much at its historic low point. Mm-hmm. So that's not the kind of policy response you would expect if income inequality is what drives inequality of political influence in the United States. So lots of pieces of evidence, no clean story that allows us to be mm-hmm. super confident in reaching this conclusion. But that, I think, is the best conclusion to draw from the evidence we do have.
So I want to tell a different story and see where you find disagreement, because, you know, I think inequality, like you say, is one of like many forces at play in determining how politics ends up working out, what kinds of policies end up being enacted. I think very few like smart people would say that we think inequality is like the only thing that would determine, you know, whether or not tax cuts get proposed or something like that. So I mean, the story that I would tell is more about populism, and we've seen some evidence of this recently in a few, at least a couple of studies that I was able to find around the relationship between people's self-perceived inequality and their support for far-right and, in some cases, far-left populist groups. And to me, like, when I look at the potential threat to democracy right now, like, the biggest threat I see worldwide is the rise of far-right populism. Particularly, I mean, you see this in the United States, you see this in Germany, you see this in France, you see this in the Netherlands, like, Australia, New Zealand. I mean, you see it all over the world. And it is, to me, like, one of the big questions is, why do we see this happening? And I don't think there's one simple, clean answer there. But I do see a story that you can tell that people's self-perceptions of inequality lead them to have, you know, declining trust, which is what we also observe in many of these same countries. And that pushes you towards populist ideas and populist leaders. And so that is, I think, one that, you know, a theory that has not been, I mean, I think it's bandied about a lot, but I don't think it's like been super well tested. But it seems like very, very plausible to me that we would be concerned about this, given what we know about the individual level. So how do you think about that story?
Yeah, I think it's, again, very plausible hypothesis. But the research that we have so far isn't very supportive. Again, looking over time within these, and here I should step back, I guess, and say for some of your listeners or watchers that I'm focusing here just on these rich democratic countries. The causal processes and policy recommendations could well, and in some cases almost certainly are very different for low-income and middle-income countries. But both over time and across these rich democratic countries, income inequality doesn't correlate very well with the level or rise of populism. We see really strong vote support for populist parties or candidates in some of the countries where you'd least expect it, if inequality plays a big role. In Sweden, in Norway, populist parties have consistently polled and gotten vote shares around 15 to 25%. In Austria, they've had one of the most successful far-right populist parties and movements in any of these countries. France is one of the countries where, depending on the inequality measure, there's been very little increase over time, and yet, you know, as is well known, the populist right is quite strong there. I look in the book, I do a, you know, sort of a very brief, very simple look at, well, what happens if you combine high levels or changes of income inequality with also slow growth of incomes? Those two things don't have to go together, but what if you get both of them? And again, there's just no real predictive ability. So I think, once again, very plausible hypothesis, surely some support, but when we look closely at the big overtime and across country patterns, we'd expect to see if this were having a you know, a sizable, strong effect, one that would allow policymakers to be somewhat confident that if they actually kind of twisted the dial and could reduce inequality, they'd see some decline in support for populism. I just don't think we see that in the evidence.
So I think that the core of a lot of what you're talking about is that there are trade-offs here for what policymakers focus on, and that if they're focusing on reducing inequality, whether or not there might be some, you know, benefit in certain areas, you're not focusing in other places where there are potentially, like where there are definitely better, there's better evidence that it would benefit humanity or these different populations. So what would you prefer that policymakers focus on? Like, for you, what are you concerned about that they're spending their too much time on this rather than what kinds of issues?
Yeah, so it's partly kind of time and focus and attention that where there's trade-offs, but there also are some other issues like, or policy proposals like, say, a universal basic income, where, you know, in the abstract, I think this would be a great thing, but it turns out if you take it seriously as a real basic income, it's very expensive. And so one might seriously consider if we were persuaded that income inequality is not only unfair, but has harmful effects on other things that we value, that we care about, that we want to improve, it might make sense to make a trade-off between some of the services that government provides and a universal basic income. We might say, okay, let's take away government money for health insurance or early education, child care, elder care, something along those lines, and replace it with a universal basic income, because not only would that provide some supports for the poor, but it would reduce inequality. And that's going to have ripple effects on health. It's going to allow people to live longer. It's going to improve their living standards. It's going to make democracy better. Mm-hmm. That would be a smart choice if we were persuaded that income inequality has these harmful effects. Again, because I don't think that the evidence suggests it does. I wouldn't want to make that trade-off. So what I think we should do, you know, if our policies are, I would say start by more or less copying the Nordic policy package. So get a big, robust, largely but not entirely universal welfare state that significantly enhances economic security, almost certainly is better for equal opportunity, for capability enhancement, probably also makes people happier, more satisfied with their lives, and then go from there. And what that largely means is a wide array of affordable, high-quality services, a bunch of public insurance programs, and also some simple payments, like a child allowance. That's, you know, it's not replacing any income. It's not like unemployment insurance or old age pensions. It's just giving people some money. It's a little bit based on having some kids. But so do this, get these policies up and running, and then also try to do some stuff on the, you know, to use the now popular term, pre-distributive side. Make sure that you're doing well by wages, whether that means through strong labor unions or, more realistically, in many of these countries, something like a minimum wage, maybe, that varies depending on the sector or type of employment people are in. Try to keep the labor market tight as much as you can. Probably use an earned income tax credit to supplement wages. And then try a variety of other things to make people's lives better, some of which are going to also have the effect of reducing measured income inequality or maybe wealth inequality, many of which will have the effect of reducing inequality of lived experience, you know, of real living standards or material well-being. You know, so if everybody has health insurance, that's not going to show up in an income Gini coefficient or the top 1%'s income share, but it is going to equalize people's lives. Mm-hmm. And same with many of these services and public insurance programs and transfers and also pre-distributed measures that I'm talking about.
So there was a, you know, one thing that you mentioned in the book itself is that one way that wealthy people can influence the political system is through ideas that which, you know, which ideas get attention, which ideas get, you know, heard by politicians in rooms. And this is part of the reason why I think that like people often misunderstand the way that rich people end up getting a lot of political influence in the system is often that not that they're like just literally bribing people, but that they're, you know, investing in think tanks or they're talking to these politicians and presenting them with the best arguments from their side. And then politicians may not hear the best arguments from other sides. And this is the place where I think that, like, you know, you see a real strong effect. And I mean, this is, again, to return to the Elon Musk example, I mean, we see this real discontinuity in how the right has engaged in, you know, with like the Nick Fuentes's and the far right kind of anti-Semitic part of their coalition as Elon Musk has, you know, removed the moderation on Twitter. And this is something where, like, obviously this is like a very, very difficult thing to measure, like about whether or not is this really inequality or is this really just like there's a certain level of wealth that someone can accumulate at which point they have this kind of power and inequality really isn't the question. It's just like you can't be like a trillionaire. You know, that itself is like democracy degrading. And I guess my question to you is more about the interaction between this level of inequality and social media and attention that we've the attention economy that we've created right now in our you know world, given that you literally can just like own the types of information that people are seeing, especially if you have control over algorithms that have you know the on Twitter the attention of already all of the lawmakers, all of the policymakers, all of the think tankers who are in Washington D.C., even if it is a very small proportion of the electorate. So I guess my question to you is then, like, you know, maybe you don't see that inequality per se is the problem that's leading to this democratic backsliding, but do you think that like total wealth accumulation or total income accumulation in the hands of just a small number of people can lead to some of these problems? Are you skeptical of that as well?
Well, it absolutely can, and maybe it has right now. So, you know, Elon Musk owns Twitter and is active on Twitter. Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post, is not active in writing op-eds or editorial board opinions that come from the Washington Post, but certainly has changed their editorial approach in the last year or so. And there are lots of other examples from, again, you know, funding, starting up, or just buying think tanks, mm-hmm. to magazines, to social media. There are lots of ways in which money can be used to shape ideas, shape thinking. So it's absolutely possible. And there's no question that there is some of that, whether that's a key driver of our policy development in the United States is, I think, a much bigger question. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if I ask myself, who's had more influence on the Trump administration's policies, is it Elon Musk or Stephen Miller? To me, that's easy to answer. And mm-hmm. that makes me, you know, conclude that in this particular case, it's not so much money that's driving the policies that we see coming out of the federal government in the last 9 months or so. Mm-hmm. It's more ideas. And of course, you know, Trump's own pre-commitments from his obsession with tariffs, which, you know, we know goes way, way back and is not, you know, something that Elon Musk or the Koch brothers or anyone else pressured him into. Mm-hmm. So it's complicated. And I think we want to try to look as carefully as we can before mm-hmm. we jump to conclusions that are comfortable to us. And, you know, I want to say that I'm as vulnerable to going for easy answers or what seem to be compelling conclusions as anybody else. So I, you know, just want to encourage everyone to be as skeptical as they can and try as hard as they can not to settle for the easy answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a part of the problem is something that you acknowledge in your book is, and we've already talked about, it's just like the speed at which we have to make decisions is faster than the journal publishing timelines of political science research. But I think that one area that we haven't talked about in depth yet is what you were able to find about happiness and inequality, because this is a place where I think you find much more mixed results. Can you talk to us about what you see?
Yeah, so the really striking fact about happiness, and here I rely on measures of life satisfaction, which is now much more commonly used. So it's data that come from a public opinion survey question that asks something like, how would you rate your life as a whole these days? Usually people are given a 0 to 10 scale. And the wording in the question encourages people to sort of reflect on well, their overall satisfaction with their life as opposed to how they feel at that particular moment in time, that minute, that day, that month, that year. And we see a pretty consistent pattern across a wide array of countries of life satisfaction responding to income. So the higher people's income, the higher country's income, the more people are satisfied with their life. And yet, in the rich democratic countries since the 1970s, GDP per capita has gone up pretty steadily to varying degrees depending on the country, but it's gone up everywhere. And yet, we really haven't seen any change in life satisfaction. And there are various data sources here, but they all tell a pretty similar story. And that's fairly puzzling. I mean, there are a few exceptions, but they're mostly minor. This is a relatively common pattern across these countries. So that's a puzzle. And one obvious possibility is that, well, what separates this period from prior periods where we did see life satisfaction, again, the data are pretty limited, pretty scattered, but it does appear that life satisfaction was going up with GDP per capita. And that's a very strong pattern across the countries. So one of the things that is different in this recent period since the late 1970s is the rise of inequality. And there's very good reason to think that income inequality will reduce life satisfaction. We're social creatures. We compare ourselves to others. So if we feel like, even if our absolute living standards or income or well-being is going up, if we feel like we're farther behind our reference group, whoever that reference group is, it's our next door neighbor or the person in the cubicle next to us at work, whoever we see on TV or social media, then we might well, experience no rise in life satisfaction, or maybe even a decrease. So maybe our life satisfaction will go up because of our income, but then go back down because we feel we're further behind our reference group. So very plausible hypothesis, but once again, we just don't see much in the way of the expected outcome. We would expect to see more of a flattening or maybe even a decrease in life satisfaction in countries like the United States, which have experienced the biggest rise in income inequality, and maybe a gain in life satisfaction in the countries with no rise in income inequality or the smallest rise. And that's just not what we observe. So here, this is one of the outcomes where I feel less confident in drawing a strong conclusion because we're gaining more and more knowledge about what are the things that do affect happiness and life satisfaction? But social scientists still really struggle to, put together an overall compelling causal story that says, these are the things that are the really key drivers. And so, I want to say, like with all of them, but especially with this, I could be wrong. But once again, I don't think we see at the country level the things we would expect to see if income inequality were having a strong effect. And what we would hope to be able to bring to policymakers and say, look, you care about happiness now, life satisfaction, reduce income inequality. That'll improve things. I don't think we have the evidence that would support that kind of recommendation.
Well, Lane, always our last and final question. What is an idea you've come across recently that you want to argue against?
So there are so many with me, but at the same time, there's so few because, again, I try to give people and ideas the benefit of the doubt until we have sort of strong evidence. So I guess I want to stick with one on our topic for today. Just by coincidence, a few days ago, it came out, or at least I found out that there's a letter by, it's It's said to be from economists and inequality experts urging the United Nations to create something like an IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, for mm-hmm. inequality. The idea is that this is a big, really important issue, and we need more evidence, we need more attention to it. And so this followed on a report that was, I think, sponsored by the G20, or at least prepared mm-hmm. for the G20 a short while ago. Joe Stiglitz was one of the lead authors, and made essentially the same kind of argument. Inequality is a big problem. We need to look more closely at it. It should get more attention. And so the thing that I want to, I guess, take issue with, I have no opposition to this at all. I agree inequality is a big, important issue, and it would be great if there were more attention to it and more research on it. But the problem with this particular letter is they say the purpose of this panel would be to increase our understanding of the causes and consequences, and then maybe potential solutions for inequality. But then they go on to say that part of the rationale for doing it is because we already know that inequality has a variety of harmful effects. So they basically say that the argument in favor of doing it is that we already know this, and yet the purpose of the panel is to try to tell us more about it. So I really wish that they had written the letter in a way that didn't presuppose that that we already know the answer to one of the mm-hmm. questions they think this panel would be designed to raise and to investigate.
In some ways, it's a narrow objection, but I actually think there's a deeper one here, which is that, you know, I think that often panels like this are, the goal of them is not to necessarily really do independent new research. It's to make more public what people already think to be true, which is like a big concern if you don't believe that the conclusions people are drawing are accurate or supported by evidence.
I'm sure that's right. I'm sure there are some people who signed on to this or promoting this idea or signed on to the letter who really just want more evidence. And mm-hmm. there are probably others who are already convinced and really would just like more publicity, more attention yeah. drawn to it, see this as a mechanism.
Well, Lane, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been great having you.
Thank you. Delight to be here.
The Arguments production team includes Ranjini Chakraborty, Isabella Pereira, Angela Tracy, Kate Crawford, and Eli Richman. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. If you want to hear more from The Argument, you can become a subscriber at theargumentmag.com.